Remaker's Mark, Episode 61, The Cell. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Remaker's Mark. Here we are in the second part of our discussion of the psychological, horror-ish thriller, The Cell. With me, as always, are my friends Andy Wicks. Andy, one, how are you doing tonight? And two, just because, are you a J-Lo person or a Mariah Carey person?
Sorry.
Wow.
Oh, I thought I was past that. I'm okay. My decaffeinated Earl Grey tea is apparently stronger than I thought.
Earl Grey, hot.
I'm going to go with J-Lo or Mariah Carey. I'm going to go pink.
Nice.
Wow. Nice. Left turn. I like it. Well done. Jeremy Nilsson, how are you tonight? And who would you choose, J-Lo or Mariah Carey?
I am doing excellent. And if we're going for when they were in their prime, I would say Mariah Carey. If I had to choose them right now, I would probably say Mariah Carey.
Good clarifying statement. Thank you. Lee Hookhangin, how are you tonight? And who would you choose, J-Lo or Mariah Carey?
I'm good. And neither. I've never been a fan of either one. So,
all right, fair enough.
Lee was born a Cher fan, and he will die a Cher fan.
Celine Dion, all the way.
Yes,
nice. Mark Josting, how are you? And what about you, J-Lo or Mariah Carey?
One, I'm well, thank you. And two, do I have to?
No, you don't have to. You can plead the musical fifth. Here, I'll give you one. Ready?
Yeah, but you also have to sing a musical fifth.
Like a perfect fifth?
Nice. I think you got it. I think that was close enough.
Nope.
My name is Kyle Delahunt. I will be your host once again this fine evening. And boy, I think if it was music-wise, I would probably go with Mariah Carey, even though I would probably listen to more J-Lo music than Mariah Carey music. That said, if I wanted to hang out with somebody, it would probably be J-Lo. So not that it's very likely in either direction, but still. There we are. Now we are going to move on to the Remaker's Mark Recommends segment. Lee, this was your movie, so you get another recommendation for it. What will you be recommending this evening?
I will be recommending a channel on YouTube called The Try Channel. I don't know if anyone's familiar with that.
No.
But it's,
nope.
It's essentially a group of Irish folks who try different things. And it's really funny.
Is it the TRY channel?
The what?
The TRY channel?
Yeah.
Is that okay. Different than the Try Guys?
I don't know.
They are not Irish.
It's not the Try Guys, okay. Then. This is all Irish people who, you know, fans will send them certain different things like ciders from wherever, from England. Or they'll send them craft beers from Minnesota, and they've got groups of two or like pairs of people just trying each thing and commenting on it. And it's actually pretty funny. And I've been watching it for, I don't know, probably the better part of the last year. And it's pretty entertaining. So they post videos Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. And I've really been enjoying it.
Cool.
Excellent.
So check it out.
I've never heard of that before. I look forward to
it. It looks interesting.
Yeah, there's one that they posted, or actually a bunch of videos that they posted early last year, right before the pandemic hit. They took a trip to Orlando, Florida, and went to Disney and did the drink around the world thing. And they tried a bunch of different American treats. And those are especially funny videos. I actually go back and watch those. I've watched them many times. So I would recommend starting with those.
All right. Very good. Thank you, Lee. Now, before we talk about part one, let's talk about what our next movie is going to be. Mark, you are up next. Do enlighten us.
Thank you. I will. And boy, will I ever enlighten you. Because I have found the gap in our viewership the thing which we've never watched before.
Ooh.
Oh, no.
Oh, boy.
And that is the whatever it is that happens when Motown Records produces a kung fu movie.
Say more.
What?
That's right. Okay. We're going to be watching Berry Gordy's The Last Dragon.
Nice.
Ooh, wow.
I watched that so many times as a kid.
Yeah, I saw it as a kid. I haven't seen it since, but I have some fond memories of it.
I don't think I've seen
it. Get ready for those memories to either be accentuated or destroyed.
I vote destroyed.
I've rewatched it recently, and it's quite bat crazy. So.
Yeah. I'm assuming you do not mean the new Disney movie Raya and the Last Dragon.
That's no. Raya, thank you. And no.
Yes, thank you.
This is the 1985 movie, once again, produced by Motown Records. And yes, it is like a wading pool full of crazy.
Amazing.
I can't wait.
All right, very good, Mark. I am incredibly excited about that. I have not seen it. I feel like I've heard of it, but I know nothing about it. So I'm intrigued as I'll get out. And I love that there's a varying degrees of people familiar with it. That makes me super happy. All right, now let us move on to a quick recap of our part one discussion, where we recast three major characters and the director of the film. The first major character was that of Peter Novak, originally played by Vince Vaughn. We went with Andy's choice of Michael Rooker. Andy, well done.
Yay.
For the role of Carl Starger, originally played by Vincent D'Onofrio, we went with my choice of Chris Messina. For the role of Catherine Dean, originally played by the aforementioned J-Lo, we went with Mark's choice of Carrie Coon, which I say is quite inspired. Well done.
Yay!
And then for the director, originally directed by Tarsem Singh, we went with Jer's choice of Guillermo del Toro, which really can't go wrong with Guillermo, ever.
Yay!
Well done. We're all so excitable. I just barely stand it. Okay, so now let us talk about the film as a whole. So we're going to be talking about what we liked about the movie, what we maybe didn't like, what we change, and what we appreciate. Kind of the plot, tech, and filmmaking things. First thing that we want to talk about is the thing that I think gets the most attention for, which is its production design and style. It has a lot of both. Jer, you kind of started that discussion in our notes here. Do you mind giving that a start, and we'll carry on from there?
I'll start my segment of this with the subheading for this particular chapter, which is, oh boy.
Yes.
I think that without the amazing cinematography and visuals of this movie, it would just be a really bad Silence of the Lambs ripoff. And I think it really gets set apart by what it did, both CG wise, but then just really the set design and the costume design, and just this movie is filled with so much wonderful imagery, and also the soundtrack is really great, and creepy, but I watching it for the podcast, that was the first time I'd seen it since, I don't know, probably 10, 15 years or whatever, and it was still very unsettling to watch, both because of some of the really graphic visual images in it, but then also just it's an unsettling movie. They do some really great things with some audio cues and visual cues, and there aren't very many like jump scares, but it's just creepy, and I appreciated that it for that. I even though I knew what was going to happen because I'd seen it before, I'm still watching it off balance. It's kind of a similar feeling to The Shining, which always sort of keeps you not quite comfortable as you're watching it. And I thought that it did a similar thing in a very different way.
Yeah, well put. It's a different mood than The Shining, but I think the end result is the same. And it's hard to watch The Shining now with 1975 eyes. Is that right? Something like that. You know, I feel like that would have felt even more powerful then. Not, you know, not like it's not powerful now, but I think you know what I mean. You know, it's definitely feels like a movie of that era, but still is highly unique. And I would say the exact same thing of this. What did you guys think about the inside world versus the outside world? I mean, I feel like the outside world was a little bit of a throwaway, like outside of the brain, I should say, whereas the inside world had so much attention paid to it. I think it was fine, but I was curious to see what you guys thought as far as how, you know, did they just kind of blow their wad on the inside the brain stuff? And then it was like, yeah, then there's stuff out in the real world, too.
I kind of feel like they could have made the outside world feel more boring.
Oh, interesting.
I agree.
There's a contrast between what happens inside the mind and what happens in, you know, real life. And I feel like they could have played that up, you know, maybe desaturated colors or something. But there was a lot of just normal that was that took place in the real world, and a lot of really, really not normal that was inside of Starker's mind. I think that the normal stuff could have been just boring, and it would have played to great effect.
Okay.
I think it actually did. I mean, it's the outside, the real, quote, real world is, you know, it's very pedestrian and very plain, and it's nothing to look at. And I think that that just accentuates everything that you see inside his mind. And yeah, I mean, they could have taken that even further and just made it even more boring. But, you know, it was pretty boring already. And I think that worked.
Even the way that it was filmed was not exciting. It was a lot of static camera shots, and it almost felt in a lot of ways like a episode of Law and Order.
Yeah.
Outside. There was interesting. A lot of big sweeping helicopter shots. There might have been a couple watching the cars, you know, the car drive out to the farm and whatever else. But for the most part, a lot of the conversational pieces and the meeting with that family and everything else, it was all very static camera, just sort of like point and shoot sort of things.
And then when you see, like in the beginning, when she's in a therapy session with that kid who's catatonic, you know, in that sort of desert setting, it's like all the camera shots are very sweeping, and they're very wide shots. They're showing all of the scenery, and it's very colorful. I think that's kind of a nice contrast to what, you know, the way it was shot outside of that.
Yeah, because the environment is not that different from where ultimately the women are being held. You know, it's kind of a desert. You know, it's a little bit less exciting, but yeah, it's not drastically different. That's a good call. Another thing that makes me think of is kind of almost a disdain for the normal that starts in the office, I guess, or the room where basically those funky like meat muscle suits that they put on are. Is that redundant? Meat muscle?
Yeah. I do want to point out that, and I'm not 100% sure this is true, but I did read from somewhere that those are actually reused from Bram Stoker's Dracula.
Oh my God, that's amazing.
Because it's the same costume designer.
Oh my God, that's great.
Wow.
Though that's his armor and when he was Count Vlad.
Yeah.
Oh my God, that's so perfect.
I don't know that that's true, but I read it on the internet, and
it's irrefutable.
That's all you need these days.
That's right.
And I really want it to be true.
Oh my God, that's awesome. I love that. Thank you. I shall. Now that my mind has been blown, I might be a little bit off, but I could totally see that. You know, I think it starts there, and then all the magic in the movie happens inside the dream or the, you know, world of the psychologist. Let's talk a little bit about kind of breaking it down here. I would love to look at the costumes. Mark, you made a point of that, and a little bit of the makeup too, so if you want to touch on that too.
You know, as with life, I think that variety is the spice. And God, just every scene there was something different and something amazing. In Starker's mind, he has so many different personas, and they're all dressed differently and in very weird ways. Like I imagine that some producer gathered the costume and makeup departments together and just said, "Hey, everybody, remove your filters.
Yeah.
Just do whatever the hell interests you." because there were some very, very unusual things happening in this movie. I loved it.
I think that might be why that if we're looking for reasons why the movie made any of us feel off balance or uncomfortable, I think it's a lot of the imagery, because it's imagery that we're not used to seeing and haven't seen before. Like, the first time I watched this, it was kind of like, it felt like, the first time I watched, The Exorcist, because I felt really unsafe throughout the entire viewing of that. Even during the down times when there was really nothing happening, I was just kind of waiting for the ball to drop.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And that's, that's exactly what, this movie made me feel. And I think it has a lot to do with, because the imagery was so different and so out there.
Yeah, it is pretty alien. It's nothing that we're used to, nothing that's comfortable.
There was a scene towards the end of the movie where I think it's when J-Lo's character starts to kind of take control of the dream world. Maybe it's when she brings him into her mind.
Yeah.
But there starts to build along the edge of the TV screen, that sort of lattice work or whatever.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
And I remember thinking the first time I saw that, how that blew my mind that was happening. And it's like, what such a small thing used to such a really great effect.
Yeah, I can kind of picture it in my head, but I really need to go back and do it. But I can picture it a little bit, and it is really cool. I agree. So we've talked about the costumes, the makeup a bit, and then the last thing I want to touch on, sort of, is the special effects in the movie. So, you know, we've talked a lot about how the production design goes into that, but the special effects certainly play a big part in that. Lee, I feel like you chimed in on that. Want to share a little bit of your thoughts there?
Yeah, I mean, at the time, you know, in 2000, when CGI was still relatively, you know, in its infancy, I was struck by how stunning the visuals were. And I could tell that a lot of it was CGI, but I was impressed at the time at how it looked. Now, like watching it in standard def, it's, you know, you can kind of tell that it's not as polished. But what I think makes up for that is like the design, like the surrealness of, you know, the worlds inside their minds. And I did appreciate that. I could tell that there was a mix of CGI and practical effects, and, you know, they worked together fairly seamlessly. This was just a couple of years from, you know, movies just doing everything on a soundstage and just having everything be CGI. But I really liked that part of this movie where, you know, there was a mix of both.
Yeah, I agree. I think the CG is certainly an opportunity. Even if you literally took the, you know, frame by frame, same look and feel, you could just do a better job of it. Some of the kind of, I don't know, interstitial effects, almost like transitionary effects, really showed their age with this. Whereas I think a lot of the big set piece ones were like the, where he has the, I don't know, like the curtain, like the big cape behind him that then spreads across the wall. Like that either was a really good practical effect or a really bad CG effect. And I think it was maybe a little bit of both, but I feel like that one could be done more organically as well. So yeah, I agree. The other thing that I thought of, the movie The Fountain by Darren Aronofsky is a, you know, pretty spacey movie, no pun intended. And the effects in that were done in a very interesting way. It was like a mixture of liquid and light. And it's kind of like how Interstellar did some of that. I feel like most of that was CG, but they did kind of a similar thing. I feel like something like that, where if you were to take something that is totally organic but looks otherworldly, I feel like that could maybe be a place where you could go to capture the mood of that world and have it still feel really unsettling and do something that was kind of, you know, new and different and exciting. Andy, I feel like you maybe didn't have a lesser reaction to this movie, but maybe had a little bit of a different reaction. One, is that fair to say? And two, I would love to hear your thoughts on the production design within that realm.
I think you are accurate. I was not a big fan of this film. And I think, while I'm not disagreeing with the points that you guys are making, the contrast between the real world and the dream world and the set designs and those kinds of things, I thought was very striking. I just thought that the real world was, yes, it was boring and it wasn't shot in a way that I felt was very engaging, even for just the real world. But the dream world to me seemed, and I mentioned this, I think, in perhaps pre-production or in our first episode, that perhaps the copy that I watched just wasn't that great because it seemed a poor man's version of a lot of other films of that era that I thought looked much, much better. So, for example, the first one that comes to mind is The Matrix. Because The Matrix was released in 1999. This movie was released in 2000. And just the visual depictions of those worlds, those respective worlds, to me was incredibly striking between night and day. I'd almost, to put it in a different context that I think members of this podcast will certainly appreciate, if not necessarily agree with, would be the original Star Wars trilogy versus the Star Wars prequel trilogy in terms of set design. I felt like the dream world was, the colors were overly saturated, that they tried to make a soundstage look very interesting, but you could still tell it was just essentially a soundstage cube sort of space. And it just didn't engage me very well. So that was kind of how I came away from this film, was that it seemed like it was trying hard to be visually stunning and maybe relying on that a little too heavily for what I felt was in the end, maybe a story that wasn't developed really well.
Yeah, I can't say I argue with you in that. I feel like if you were to break it down in terms of the plot of the movie, et cetera, that it's not a spectacular movie. I think it depends on how much that can wash over you and whether it bothers you. And I think if it can wash over you, then you're in, and it's not a guarantee that you are. So I feel like it makes sense how you can hear pretty different reactions between those two. I could see it being a pretty polarizing movie.
Andy, am I hearing you right that you're saying that Carl Starger is Jar Jar Binks?
That's what I heard.
Yep, that's pretty much what I said.
Oh, yeah, originally no. The name of Jar Jar Binks was Starger Binks, so it makes perfect sense.
Carl Binks. It just didn't test as well. No, and I want to be careful. Like, I thought the character of I almost said Carl Binks. The character of Carl Starger was very interesting and engaging and things like that, but the other characters, I was like, whatever. So I'm getting off topic.
Beautifully off topic. Okay, so let's move on. And this is an interesting movie in the role of trauma, or the role that trauma plays in it. Jer, you had some really interesting points about that I would love to hear about.
I don't even really know how to start this conversation, but I think that the movie speaks very boldly about what trauma is and how trauma affects the brain. And like all Hollywood, it's not all accurate, and it's not all, a lot of it's played up for dramatic effect. But I think that it actually does a reasonably decent job of looking at what trauma does to us. And I give them props for trying to tackle a topic like that in a way that doesn't just turn it into pseudo science and plot devices and just trying to use it to make something more exciting or whatever. There are not a lot of big blockbuster movies that work with trauma in effective and kind ways. another one that comes to mind. I think that there are more properties that are taking that challenge on here in the recent past, and I think that we're at a period in history where that's a topic that is more openly discussed now. And so I think that we're seeing a lot more of that come out in movies. The one that I would think of off the top of my head, or that I would point to off the top of my head, is the seasons of Stranger Things. I think that's a little bit more of an allegorical take on it, but that is definitely a series about trauma and how trauma is a monster. But if you look at that, especially the second season after the events of the first one, and how a variety of the characters were affected by and traumatized by the events of the first season, it really plays a very effective it plays very effectively at showing authentic trauma. And I think that The Cell does something similar in that it shows effective trauma, in that you look at how Carl Starker's brain has sort of morphed itself from these events that took place in his childhood. And they touched on that a little bit with the abuse from his father and things like that. But and how that sort of came sort of this key that created or turned his development towards these other ways to sort of stave off that trauma or meet needs that were created by the trauma. And that's where the killing started, and this sort of creation of these different personalities within his head, of this young boy and this insane demon man and everything else. And it's very fantastical, but I think that at its heart, it does a pretty decent job of showing how deeply ingrained into our mind trauma can be. And I give it props for that. I think that it's a tough topic to handle.
Agreed.
Anybody else?
Yeah, I think of the series Hannibal. I don't know if anybody's watched that, but it is... It touches on, okay, sorry, there's tons of trauma in the movie in every way. It very nearly goes deep with trauma, but it takes the light way out every time. And not like comedic light, but it never gets into authentic study. It gets into kind of like soap opera-y study or hyper-violent study, or it never quite gets there in a way that makes you feel like you can genuinely relate to or associate with it. But I feel like the mood of that is so similar in terms of the vision, the production design. A lot of that is very much the same, and it's really gruesome. I don't know how that aired on NBC. That was bonkers, but that's neither here nor there. Has anybody watched that?
Are you talking about the one with Mads Mikkelsen?
Yeah.
Yeah. I watched the first few, and then it got bogged down in the "here's all the shows I need to watch right now" list, and I have not gotten all the way through it.
I got all the way through it, and I'm glad that I did, but it took like 3 years for various reasons. Like it was on a streaming network, and then it wasn't, and so then I kind of stopped. But then when it was back on, I wasn't like super hyped to get back into it, but I'm glad I watched the whole thing just to close it off. But it's... the style of it is so interesting. I mean, there's like huge parallels between that and The Cell in that regard, but yeah, it's very interesting and real bloody. Holy mackerel. Another thing that kind of caught my eye in this is that they have, while it is not front and center, they have empathy for Carl Starger, especially Jennifer Lopez's character. You know, she understands the trauma that goes into him having the trauma that he has and behaving the way that he does. And she doesn't write it off as like, oh, this poor thing, but does enough. You know, I feel like the way they personify that with the kid in his mind, I thought was pretty interesting. And that's something that you got to be really careful when you were talking about empathizing with a serial killer, a murderer, a rapist, what have you. But I think that they did a good job of acknowledging that that can be there without making it a sympathetic character, because that's where you walk the line of it being pretty tough.
I think it would have been an interesting take for this movie to divide up the two points of view from J-Lo and Vince Vaughn's character, where Vince Vaughn was all about, he's a bad guy, he needs to be caught and go to prison or whatever else, like, he's a bad guy doing bad things, and I catch bad guys. And then on the other side, you have J-Lo, who is all on the other side of, he's only the way he is because of the things that happened to him. He can be rehabilitated. He needs to be saved, basically. And finding, having the movie float around in the gray area between those two points of view, and instead of kind of, it more or less sort of didn't answer the question, and J-Lo sort of, her point of view sort of won, kind of, in that redemption of him, of Carl, kind of happened at the end. But I think that if I, putting those two points of view farther apart and making them more polarizing and forcing the movie to kind of ask the question, like, which is right, and float around in the gray between, I think would have been a really interesting way to tell that story.
Interesting. I like that. That's a little bit of a segue, so I'm going to take it to sort of our next piece, which is, this is a, you know, ultimately a cop-ish movie and a whodunit movie, but it is by far not your average whodunit movie. In this movie, you know who the bad guy is real early. And not only that, but they, like, they get the bad guy really early. So you think, wow, this 2-hour movie is 20 minutes long. Nope, not so much. And it doesn't do it in a way where it then travels back in time, you know, 2 weeks ago, you know, 6 months ago, whatever. You know, they don't mess with time. Rather, they mess with psychology and traveling inside people's brains. And it's very interesting in that way. So I like that that's how they started with that. I think that framework was really cool. And I like that they sort of, you know, mixed it up and did something a little bit different in the whodunit realm. So I appreciate that. Lee, tell us a little bit about what you think in that way as well.
I liked that it was an interesting blend of police work and sci-fi in the story. I think I said something like The Matrix meets Silence of the Lambs or something like that. But that's what made it memorable for me was, I guess, the fact that most movies of this kind are the cops chasing the killer. And, you know, there's like a climactic chase scene and they finally get the bad guy in the end, but here they get him immediately, and it becomes all about you know, the expressed goal is not finding the killer, it's about finding his latest victim, which I think is a, you know, it's a nice twist on that kind of detective story that I really found interesting. And I mean, you could argue that Act One ends as soon as they catch him, which is very unlike, you know, a detective story.
Yeah, well put. That said, it sounds like we do have some scruples with some of the police work in there. Jared, you want to touch on that a little?
That's not what a scruple is.
Sorry. We have some qualms. How about that?
Perfect.
Umbrage?
Umbrage. There
is
we go.
Is this an umbrage moment?
I think we have a genuine umbrage.
Well, I guess my only umbrage with it is that the way that the case was solved was essentially a MacGuffin of sorts, where all they had to do was find this one symbol that Vince Vaughn happened to see in the dream world that they also saw at the very beginning of the case when they were collecting evidence and doing, you know, police work. And he then, you know, made the connection, oh, maybe this is the thing. And they tracked down where the symbol came from, this thing, which was here in this farm, or like it was the symbol was what led them to where it should have been, which you would have thought as, you know, policemen that they would have researched that symbol that they found in the basement of the killer's lair from the beginning. And it didn't need to have to come from a dream world. So yeah, good old fashioned police work my ass.
Mark, you had an interesting point that I skipped over earlier, but I think it fits in really well here, which is you had some wishes that this was actually longer, which is not often the case. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, it's not a reaction that I have very often to a film, but I feel like there's a lot of compelling story in this movie, and I think a lot of it was given kind of short shrift, and they could have spent more time just letting things breathe. I think that some things just came too easily in the investigation inside of Stargirl's mind. When Peter is trying to snap Catherine out of it, where she believes that it's real and he's having his intestines reeled up on a spit.
No big deal.
No big. It takes him all of, you know, one reminder of her real life. And then all of a sudden, then she's stabbing Stargirl in the back. And it's happened pretty quickly. And when they're looking for clues for where the victim might be, they find that symbol right away. I don't know. I feel like that's and they could have certainly spent more time on Stargirl's childhood as well.
Yeah, good points indeed, Mark. Let us move on to the performances here. Mark, let's go back to your well there. What do you have to say about that?
Two words. D'Onofrio.
Wait, is that one or two?
Maybe that was three words.
Oh, okay.
It's a word and a glottal stop.
Yeah, there we go.
Say more.
No. Yes, I will. His performance was, let's say, invested. He really, really inhabited his character Z. I feel like every time he was in a new costume, he was a different person, and he brought just so much performance with just acting with his whole body. I thought it was pretty amazing, and I really hope that he like took dance classes or something in order to pull that sort of performance out.
Wouldn't surprise me.
That's just an entertaining image in my head.
He's one of the best actors ever. Like, I mean, he's such a chameleon. You know, when you think of...
A little like Meryl Streep?
Yeah, kind of. but when you think that this is the same guy who played Private Pyle in Full Metal Jacket.
Yeah.
You know, those characters could not be any different.
Yep. The villain in Men in Black, Sugar Water Guy.
And he's amazing in all of those. Like, everything that he does is just... He's an absolutely incredible performer.
Well, even the characters that he plays in this movie are—he changes. It's not just that he changes his voice and puts on a wig or something. They are different, completely different people. The way that he carries his body, and the way that he moves, and the way that his face moves when he talks, and everything was just so drastically different.
Yeah, it was incredible. I agree completely.
There are not many actors and actresses in Hollywood that can do that to that effect.
Yeah. I will touch on J-Lo. I'm a fan overall. I haven't seen a ton. I don't, you know, like I've never seen The Wedding Planner. I feel like I've missed her pretty much entire like romantic comedy oeuvre, which it seems is quite a bit. But that said,
you haven't missed much.
Yeah. Okay. Fair enough. That said, Out of Sight is one of my all-time favorite movies. I think that is just about a perfect movie. I'm a huge Soderbergh fanboy, and man, is that movie good. And she is astoundingly good in that movie. I just think that is an amazing performance and an amazing film. That said, she kind of like is kind of whispery in that movie. Like, she plays an FBI agent. And you know, she has her shouty moments, but mostly it's kind of like seductive, her and Clooney doing their thing, which is amazing. And I think like she got too much praise for that and then just sort of whispered her way through this movie, which I was not a super huge fan of, but it didn't like completely take me out of it. But I was like, speak up, J-Lo, stop whispering. I just wanted her to talk normally. But, yeah, I think she still was good enough. And we talked a lot about
maybe that was in her contract that, she, in order to keep her singing voice protected, she had to whisper.
Oh, interesting. Bringing the Celine Dion factor in one more time. Nice. That's the name of this podcast now, by the way, is the Celine Dion factor. All right. So last but not least, let's go with our ratings of the film. This will be 1 to 10 stars, 1 being one of the worst movies you've ever seen, 10 being one of the best movies you've ever seen, in the scale of your choosing. Lee, since this was your pick, we will start with you.
I will give it 8.5 sliced horses.
Ooh, that scene is pretty rad. And awful, yeah. But yeah. Pretty rad.
There are so many scenes that are just straight up copying famous works of art, that being one of them.
Yeah.
Every one of them is done to such wonderful, disturbing beauty, I guess is the best way to put it.
Yeah. Yeah, I meant to say that in the first part when we were talking about the production design. I feel like they did an okay job, though they could have probably done a little bit better other than just like, hey, look at this art in his office of like what inspired him. I feel like that could have been, if we had the longer version that Mark talked about, I feel like that could have been tied into more. If you've seen Red Dragon, speaking of more Hannibal Lecter-y stuff, the one with Edward Norton and Ralph Fiennes, that one kind of has a similar, like they go much more in depth on one specific work, but it really helped inform who the character was. So I feel like they could kind of, go to that end a bit. Sorry, didn't mean to hijack. Good choice. Andy, how about you? What would be your rating of the film?
I'll give this one 3.8 really elaborately constructed and hidden torture cells.
You kind of stole mine. I was going to do worst dunk tanks ever, but
yours is better.
I'll think of another one suddenly. Got wixed. Dang it. Yes.
That's amazing to get wixed by that.
Yeah. And I backed into that one. That's for sure. I'll take it.
Nice. Jer, how about you?
I liked this movie, but I think through the course of our conversation, I've liked it just very slightly less. Maybe that's just Andy rubbing off.
We are critics.
Yay! That's true. I'm going to give this one 6.8 bathtub disembowelments.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Are there any other kinds?
Probably.
Yeah, you're probably right.
Yeah. And Mark, how about you? What is your rating?
I am going to give this one 8.5 intestine reels.
Gross. Nice.
Which is too many.
Some of my favorite talkies are intestine reels, I'll tell you. For my rating, I will give it 7.6 unexpected Dracula suits. Apparently they're Dracula suits. I learned that tonight. T-I-L, Dracula suits. All right. Well, kind of all over the mark there, but in a way that I think is reflective of what we've largely mentioned there. So makes sense. All right. Let us wrap this up and our discussion of The Cell up here. Remakers Mark is a proud member of the Math is Hard Network. To find out more information about this podcast or any other podcast on the network, check us out at mathishard.net. There you will find show notes with links to all of the people, movies, and links discussed in this episode. This information is also attached to the show file in the podcast client of your choice. You can find us anywhere you listen to podcasts, including Google Play and Apple Podcasts, where you can rate and review Remakers Mark, which would mean the world to us, as well as Spotify. And we are on YouTube now as well. Search for Remakers Mark. We are on Facebook at Remakers Mark, Twitter at Remakers Mark, and Instagram at Remakers Mark Podcast. So please join in the discussion there as well. So, gents, usually this is where I make a pithy statement about something in the film, and if you ever see or end up in a situation like that, it's going to be okay. If you end up in a situation like this, please tell us. There could be something terribly, terribly wrong with you, and we are here for you. You out in the audience, you can't really reach us, but, just seek help. And I hope that never happens to you, but in case you do, just also remember, the Force will be with you, and may the Force be with you.
And also with you.